Hello, 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 and welcome to the My Empty Hands podcast. This is Reggie Darden, and I have with me today Professor Chris Stewart. And so I'm really excited to be able to chat about Kenpo and whatever else happens to come up, just to kind of give a little background on me. I started Kenpo in the mid-90s in what was essentially a Tracy's school. Did that for a few years, made my way to Greenbelt. Then I left for the Army. While I was in the Army, did a little bit of Hapkido, a little bit of Taekwondo, and a little bit of boxing. After leaving the military, I then got involved into Capoeira, and I've been doing that for quite some time now. And then about a couple of years ago, I got reacquainted with Kenpo, and I am now a green belt in Kenpo again. So feels nice to just say, oh, I'm a green belt in Kenpo, instead of, oh, well, this version I had a green belt, this version I had, you know. So makes it. Just been doing the training, enjoying the training, and excited for what comes next. Also still interested in dabbling into some other arts. I'm probably going to get back into Hapkido and looking to get into some Kali and such as well. So that's just kind of a brief background, but we'll probably get into some other aspects of that as we go along. So what I'd like to know, and what the listeners would like to know, is, you know, how Kenpo found you, how you got started, and, you know, what's kind of the story of your journey in Kenpo and the martial arts.
Yeah, so I started, actually got a little introduction to both Judo and Shotokan. There's a group that came to the church that I was attending at the time, and they put on like a 7 or 8 week series for the kids at the church of both Judo and Shotokan. And I really liked it. And shortly afterwards, I became the prime subject for the local bully. And so my parents were like, oh, remember Chris was taking those lessons? Let's sign him up so that he can defend himself. And so I was coming home with your normal, you know, black and blue and bruised up. And my parents finally got sick of it. So the closest studios to me, there was either a Taekwondo studio or there was a Shaolin Kenpo under the auspices of USSD nearest to me. All the other studios were pretty far away. And to be totally honest, the traditional Shotokan didn't really appeal to me. And neither did the Taekwondo with all the kicks. So I end up in Shaolin Kenpo in 93, and I stayed with them until 2001, earning a second degree black belt. In that process, I'd gone to the instructor's college. I'd been an assistant instructor with them and attained my second degree black belt. But then the business mindset had settled in. And I came to the conclusion towards the end of it, it was nothing more than a glorified pyramid scheme. So I left USSD in 2001. I took a little bit of a break from training until I got married in right about the time I started, was engaged and was getting married. I thought, you know what, I have this experience in martial arts. I might as well use it within the church to teach self-defense. And by that point, I'd been dabbling in other arts and streamlining what I understood and knew, and started putting together a system to teach in churches. So in 2004, I joined Karate for Christ International, and they really helped me put my Christian faith into the martial arts. And I've been teaching in churches since then. It's been a nice long process. I didn't have an instructor there for about 9 years, but I had a lot of folks over Karate for Christ encouraging me, sending me videos, materials, pushing me in this process of creating a Christian martial art. And in 2011, I had come across Professor Clark Cole, who was near me when I was living in Southern California. And he just had a studio out of his garage, and he was teaching something called American Kempo. So I went by a couple of times and checked out the lessons. And the second his son mopped the floor with me after sparring, I said, okay, sign me up for lessons. So I've been with Professor Cole since 2011. So what does that make it now? 13 years. I retested for my black belt. I had basically thrown the black belt I had before into the trash, and I retested for black belt in 2014.
Okay.
Some of the listeners might actually have been at that belt test there in Southern California. And since then, I've been dabbling in other arts since I got my black belt in 2014. I've been with the Ordonez Kajukenbo Ohana, learning Kajukenbo.
Very nice.
And most recently, I've been accepted as a student of Kumo de Leon in Hawaiian Lua.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah. And so that's kind of been my journey. But my primary focus to boil all that down has been, can I have something that can affect kids be able to defend themselves against adult attackers, especially women and girls, and then also be able to introduce something that we call mercy points. So you take a technique like crossing talons, right? So our mercy point is right after you get that arm bar and you're basically sitting on their leg. It's a prime opportunity for you to have a conversation with your attacker and going, hey, dude, do you really want to continue to do this? Because if you do, I'm sorry, it's going to hurt. And having that opportunity to show grace to somebody whose intentions are not that great towards you. And so we look at the American Kempo system, Kajukenbo, and now the system that my instructor and I put together, it's called Christian Kempo, is a streamlined version of all of these different arts with the focus of mercy points and mercy choices. That's basically been my history in a nutshell without going into too much detail.
Okay. So I'm curious, and since you've been in you know, multiple versions of Kempo, so like I'm not particularly familiar with the Shaolin Kempo. So you maybe kind of break down the differences from that and, you know, the Ed Parker, you know, version of Kempo.
So Shaolin Kempo comes to us very different ways. I'm sure eventually you'll be able to get Professor Joe Ribello, Kempo Joe, on your program, and he can tell you in a lot more detail than I can. Shout out, Joe, if you're listening. Shaolin Kempo comes to us from a guy named Nick Serio, mainly, who had blended together versions of Okinawan forms with some self-defense techniques from Japanese Kempo and brought it to the mainland. It's also kind of a splinter off of another splinter off of Kajukenbo. Now, a lot of this is debated, and I'm not going to go into the history of the debates about who gave who what belt and how and who broke off of who.
Yeah, we don't need the politics in the drama here.
Yeah, I don't need the politics. There's already enough of that. So Nick Serio ended up teaching it to a couple of different folks. The first one was Fred Villari, who'd started the United Studios of Self-Defense on the East Coast. And then one of his students, Charles Matera, started other version of United Studios of Self-Defense that mainly hit East Coast and West Coast. And then recently, in the last decade or so, USSD has split and has become Z Ultimate and USSD. It predominantly focuses, they try and have an alignment with the Shaolin Temple. They take trips of students there every year to go test and to compete, which I think is really odd because it's a Japanese-styled system that they're performing in front of Shaolin monks. When I was there, so in the late 90s, they made this push towards having kung fu forms. So having a leopard form and having a crane form. And it was kind of like an add-on to the system just to kind of appease the monks at the Shaolin Temple. So USSD and Shaolin Kempo, like in the late 80s, early 90s, there was the ninjutsu craze. So that was another name that was put on the front. Oh, yes, we do karate, we do kung fu, we do ninjutsu, you know, just try and get students. And it's kind of a – it morphs into whatever is the business model of the day. Mm-hmm. But basically there's forms which are copycats of the Shotokan forms, the pinions, different names. And then there's self-defense techniques predominantly against punches, very few grabs, holds, hugs, locks, chokes, a few, to be totally honest, really horrible knife and gun defenses that'll get somebody killed. But that's Shaolin Kempo in a nutshell. Valari and Matera are the ones who really push it and its popularity in the United States. As it compares to American Kempo, there's really no comparison between the two. It's like comparing an apple and an orange. The only thing that it shares is a name, Kempo. Mr. Parker really took the Japanese style Kempo and put logic and concepts and principles to it and basically turned it upside down and created something that has 154 base techniques, 96 extensions. So 250 techniques against a variety of different attacks that allow somebody to have a vocabulary of motion to defend themselves.
Yeah, yeah. That's definitely something that I love about it. And I love in the training. So when I train originally, you know, I love my school. Love the original school, love my original teacher, and you know, really love the training that I did. But when I started, it started again. I learned a lot more of the principles and the blueprints and the why versus the how, and I feel like I gained a lot more knowledge, kind of the second go around, because I developed a better understanding of why we're doing, you know, techniques. Because I mean, my original training, we had, you know, 40 techniques per belt, and you know, I tell my classmates now, and they're like, that's a lot to have to memorize and learn. And it's like, you know, yeah, we did it, but you know, we didn't do a lot of, you know, we didn't do the terminology, we didn't do the sayings, we didn't learn, you know, all that juicy vocabulary that, you know, really brings up the mental part of it. We focused more on the physical. So, you know, having that mental part of it is just as important, if not more so than the physical. So, yeah, I could really see the difference in the training, and then as I've been moving up, I've been able to kind of start working, kind of trying to work that in, and I want to kind of go back and battle test, so to speak, my previous training, and kind of see, oh, okay, well, this is where you know, these things fit and where these things don't fit. I kind of liken it to seeing the kind of the DNA. So some of the techniques that exist, you know, in the Tracy version, I like to refer to them as the Kempo All-Star techniques, the ones that show up in every version, at least as far as I've seen. So, you know, your five swords, your thundering hammers, you know, show up in every version. So I see like kind of the DNA of how, oh, well, this technique kind of evolved and changed in this way. So I really feel fortunate to be able to see the multiple sides. I didn't realize that there were, you know, so many different kind of versions and flavors and spins on it. So I've been real excited to enjoy that.
Yeah, I totally encourage you to go down that road. As I tell my students, there's kind of three elements of Kempo. There's the mental, and there's the physical, and then there's the spiritual. Everybody brings their own spirituality into it and their own morals and their own compass. But the mental and the physical side, many karate studios focus on the physical. It's the monkey see, monkey do. Okay, you do this, then you do this, then you do this, then you're done. Mm-hmm. Versus asking the questions like you've found is why? Why are we doing a thrusting inward block? Why is it not a sweeping block? Why is it a hammer fist instead of a knife hand? Why? Those questions are important. And if we just say, well, you do it just because, that's not a good model of training that sticks with people. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We take what's called the Socratic method. I don't know if you studied that at all, of asking a series of pointed questions to help somebody come to a conclusion. You already know ahead of time what the conclusion is going to be as the person asking the questions, but you're guiding them on this journey of self-understanding what the answer is going to be. So we take any of our self-defense techniques. Let's just pick crossing talons since we already mentioned it. Is what is the main lessons within crossing talent? Not to put you on the spot, but what would you say right now is the main lesson starting at the attack, the defense, and the concepts and principles that are in it?
As far as, you know, the attack part of it, I see it as, you know, I think a likely scenario or likely application is, you know, you've got your attacker and, you know, maybe he's grabbing a, you know, lady's arm to, you know, hey, like I'm going to, you know, take you and, you know, throw you in my van, kind of situation. So I see that as kind of a very likely scenario versus, you know, some guy's just going to grab you in the 7-Eleven and, you know, say, hey, give me your money. But, the grab, or kind of the other likely scenario is, you know, they're grabbing their arm so that so they can, you know, pull you into, you know, a punch. That punch is coming with that other hand. So that'd be the attack aspect. In the defense, getting that arm within, not only gaining control of them and affecting the different zones, but also kind of getting that arm out of the way and you know, readjusting their position also takes away their other weapons and allows you to defend. So
yeah, that's a great start in that. And so what we encourage our students to do is there's space at the bottom of the technique sheet. And all it says is lessons. And then you fill in the lessons from the lesson we're learning of what's a crosshand wrist grab, what's some of the intent behind it, and then what are the lessons? So in anchoring our elbow and pointing our fingers, we're already manipulating his arm to place it in such a way that we can lock up five or more joints at one time. We're manipulating his height, his width, and his depth at the same time, giving us time. Thank you, Clyde O'Brien. Side note. But that is a lesson from Clyde O'Brien in Southern California. So if Clyde's listening, thanks, Clyde.
Awesome.
Giving us time to then manipulate him and continue to cancel that height, width, and depth, giving us new targets, right? With him bent over in that way, in what we call double negative body posture, we've got the mastoid, we've got the temple, and we could go into the crank, and then that moment in which we can have that conversation, we get the neck crank and go, dude, are you done? And then finishing the technique. What this guided conversation we have with our students, I think, to be honest, everybody should do. But it takes time. It slows down the system, but increases the mental learning versus just the, okay, we get his arm, put him in a lock, put his head down towards the ground, we crank his neck, okay, we're done. There's a different philosophy of training that is emphasize there.
Gotcha. So something that I'm still struggling with coming from the different versions is, I don't know, I guess a little muscle memory or not sure how you want to call it, but have you found, did you have any kind of struggles going from the different versions, or, you know, specific habits that you had to break, or were you able to just kind of go, okay, I'm wiping the slate clean and let's get started anew, or how did that go for you?
Yeah, certainly. I remember two specific lessons in which Professor Cole, I continued to just wipe away what I'd learned before, but muscle memory and just habit makes you do things a certain way. So for instance, in Shaolin Kempo, their sidekick isn't a regular traditional sidekick where you would use the heel. They teach more of, it's a bladed kick. You're using the edge of your foot. And so it took forever to get the concept of getting my leg in a position to be able to strike with the heel rather than the blade. There are some of our techniques. Think of thrusting prongs, in which we do somewhat use a side blade kick to knock out the leg, right? But it shows up so rarely. Normally, we traditionally use a regular chambered side kick in most of our sparring and our defenses. And it just took forever talking about lifting up my knee to get it, my hip and my ankle aligned in the path of the target in order to, instead of using the blade. And that was a good solid maybe month of lessons of going, we need to knock this out of your head and get it to where it should be. Another one of the lessons is in Shaolin Kempo is they have a what's called a front instep kick. It's mainly targeted towards the groin, using the top of the instep of your foot. And many people call it a flipper kick. Another lesson was is erasing that from my vocabulary, because every once in a while, I would, instead of doing a front ball kick with the ball of my foot, it would end up being a flipper kick with the instep. Just little things like that, especially that first year. I would say after the first year of training, once I got about orange belt, we'd firmly squashed any of that that was in my vocabulary of motion out and put it to death and buried it and put rip Shaolin Kempo and on a gravestone, and it went away. But that's why it can be difficult going from one art to another, right? Especially the longer you're in an art, the more and more it gets ingrained. And especially in times of pressure, we always revert to the highest or to the lowest level of training.
Yeah.
Not the highest level of training, but the lowest level of training. So for me at that point, it was the Shaolin Kempo, not the American Kempo. So I'm thankful Professor Cole was really good about squashing it, going, nope. Well, you know, we don't do it like that. And we eventually put.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, I'm getting better. But yeah, I still struggle in some areas. For some reason, the naming of basics really, it doesn't really connect right in my brain, even though, you know, I'll just use simple, you know, inward hand sword, you know, yes, it makes sense that it's called that, but for just whatever reason, certain combinations of basics, the way they're worded, just doesn't stick in my head. And then there are some that I don't know, I guess could argue it one way or the other, but I know one that gets me all the time on the test, the roundhouse versus the hook punch. And in my mind, a hook, doesn't.
No.
Once I get my 10th degree, then I can change it all and make it fit my style. But yeah, that's part of growing and learning. So I'm fine.
Yeah,
fine
the
with
same
that.
Thing I found, like when you're looking at a, whether you call this a horizontal punch, or whether it's a front two knuckle punch, mm-hmm. or whether this is a vertical punch or a thrust punch. Mm-hmm. Those terminologies can get a little confusing, especially if you've dabbled in a few different arts, is differentiating between the two. That just, it's a matter of time and what you choose to continue to repeat.
Gotcha. So in these kind of interviews, we always kind of focus on the life after you know, getting the black belt and after being a black belt. But I'm curious if you have any kind of memorable moments or you know, fun situations from when you were a colored belt that you know stand out in your mind. And
yeah, there are a few. I remember we had this tradition in the studio I grew up in, where when it was your birthday, you got birthday beatings. not real beatings. It was with padded sticks, and it was for fun. And you kind of went on the gauntlet, and everybody got to paddle you with whether it was some punching mitts that were padded or a scream of sticks that had padding on them. We still kind of continue that tradition as well. But I remember specifically my 13th birthday, entering into being a teenager, and that was remarkable because the class was actually on my birthday. And so I got to run through the gauntlet and got the beatings commenced. Another fun thing was I think it was my green belt test. Everybody seemed to be smelling a little bit ripe. And so the instructor that was running the test was like, you know what, for Christmas, I'm buying you all deodorant. But it was another fun one. Another memorable thing when I started over in American Kempo, my orange belt test. It really sticks out to me. It was in my instructor's garage in summer in Southern California. And that particular day, it was in the 90s, and actually the humidity was a little bit up. And if I remember, it was like a 3.5 hour test. I was done. That was a giant human mop. Just dragged me off of the mats and I'm done. That's one of the ones I'm proud to get through. And then what my retesting then for black belt, I was just coming off of had a knee injury. My daughter decided to jump up on my knees while my legs were out on a ottoman and hyperextended my knee 2 weeks Ouch. Before the test. Yeah. So I'm like, how am I going to get through this? So I did. Didn't look great. Wasn't anywhere near where I wanted to be, but you get through it. You push through it, especially the sparring portion. I remember my instructor's son, Jack, hit me with this 3 combination kick. And there's a video of it on YouTube. Mm-hmm. The whole test is on there on YouTube for everybody to poke at me. But he hits me with a front kick. He goes up for a roundhouse, and then he brings the roundhouse back again and gets me right here, right on the side of my head. And I didn't see any of those.
Oh, goodness. Yeah.
So that's another memorable moment. But especially my black belt test, I had a lot of support from the local community there in Southern California. Dr. Dave Crouch, also some of Bob White's black belts were there.
Very nice.
Alohe Kai from Hawaii was there. It was a blessing to have that much support to be there for a podunk test of me.
Yeah, no, I hear you. It's kind of funny when you mentioned the smelly thing. I was instantly transported to my original school, and when I started, we still had the orangey red shag carpet, and those were. That was great for holding in all of the smells. And it was just remember, you know, going to the studio, and just even before you get to the door, it's like, oh, there's a karate school around here. So it was quite a great day when we finally got rid of that carpet and cut down on some.
Yeah, we had similar first studio, as in it had some of the really dark brown shag carpeting, only for a little while, and that it finally stunk so bad they pulled it out and they got some of that commercial grade carpeting. It was really thin. It was basically you were on top of a concrete slab.
Yeah.
So we didn't have mats. We didn't have tatami. We didn't. It was basically concrete with this little tiny thin layer of carpet on top of it.
Reminding me of, fortunately it was, well, I guess fortunately and unfortunately, my original Greenbelt test tape was lost to damage. But I remember just being just completely wiped out. I kind of a little bit regret. I had got a really nice super heavyweight gi not too long before the test, so that's already weighing on me pretty hard, and then being soaked with sweat, and remember getting to the sparring portion and had to fight, you know, two fresh guys, and I was just getting pounded, and one of the guys, my buddy Max, if he's listening, I was so tired, and he was just pounding me, and I'm not sure if he still is, but he was an unbelievable kicker back in the day, and I remember just trying to run away from him, and he just turned around and he just smacked me in the head with a hook kick as I was turning my back to him, which, you know, I obviously shouldn't have done, but I just really wanted to get away from that beating. So, that was the thing that I wish I had the tape so that I could see it, but I'm glad that the tape is gone so that it doesn't end up on YouTube. Because I just got pounded. But you know, it was good time and made me stronger. So I can't fault that too much. So going through your training over all these years, is there something that, well, I guess we'll kind of go two ways with this. One, is there something that maybe you used to do that you don't see in kind of training now? And then vice versa, is there something that maybe we do now that you wish you would have, you know, been part of your training previously?
Been part of. I'll take the second one first. When I had restarted and went back to white belt, I really wish that instead of the monkey see, monkey do method of training, it would have been, why are we doing this? What are we doing to our opponent? How does this technique fit in with the rest of the system? Is there any relations? Is there a new motion that you've learned? Is there a new concept that you've learned? I wish those questions would have been drilled into me from the beginning, but it is what it is. Now, methods from the past that I wish were still continuing was, I think in the majority of commercial studios, there's always now this fear of getting sued. Versus when I started in 93, you know, the early 90s, it was still... there wasn't that fear of, oh man, we can't have more intense sparring sessions because somebody's going to get hurt. Or specifically, I remember as a brown belt in sparring, I was judging and reffing, and one of the guys got kicked into the glass, to the mirror wall, and it broke one of the panels of mirrors. And we were just worried that he was okay instead of being worried, oh man, is he going to sue? Is his parents going to sue? It really changes the way we have to look at things and the way we train versus not necessarily the way we would like to train. And I think that has had a negative effect on the quality of students coming down versus I trained in some guy's garage and it wasn't a commercial studio. And it's not like if I'm suing him, I'm not going to get much, much out of him. You know, there's not a big business to a cash cow to pull money from. So it's a matter of the method and intent of training, I think, is different. And some of the best martial arts instructors, you know, Frank Trejo taught out of his garage. We see Mr. Parker himself, the majority of times, he wasn't in Pasadena doing the lessons. He was at his home. And the family can attest to the times that people were over taking lessons, or my instructor, Mr. Cole, taking lessons from Pat Salantri at his home in Southern California and telling of the stories of, you know, if somebody's actually trained with that person, if they can describe unique attributes about the home or about the furniture in the home because they bumped into it or hit their heads on it a number of times. That mindset is vastly different, I think, today than it ever was before. For instance, here at the church where I pastor, I teach downstairs in our basement on concrete. Now we are going to be getting some pads here soon, but for the last 2 years has been a concrete slab floor training with shoes on. And it has had some beneficial effects for our students, a toughening of themselves and their attitudes rather than having a really squishy 2-inch mat underneath them.
Gotcha. Very nice. So what kind of changes have you seen now that, you know, MMA is you know, grown in popularity, and how has that affected, you know, your school and the students and kind of the people that come in? Is there a different, so I think of, you know, number of years ago, you know, people would start martial arts and they would have this, you know, idea of, you know, the Karate Kid and Mr. Miyagi and that sort of thing, and have kind of this, I don't know, different respect, different attitude. And I think now there is more of, oh, well, you know, I want to be like this, you know, I guess lack of better term, this caricature of a fighter. And I feel like MMA has a different, you know, maybe less respect, more about the spectacle than the, you know, values that you would typically find in your, you know, quote unquote traditional martial arts. So I'm just curious as how that kind of attitude has changed, and people are still looking for the you know, Mr. Miyagi, or are they looking for the Cobra Kai
I think you've already hit it, the nail on the head, so to speak. When I had started training, it was most of the people there were there for self-defense or for fitness. They weren't there to try and be the next Conor McGregor or any of the big names in MMA. Now, when UFC first started, less rules. It was more of what is their training and what is their physical state, and are they going to be able to last? And it was more of a true testing of skills and training and endurance. But obviously, like most sports, rules keep coming in and limitations, obviously for the safety of the fighters and those that are around. But then it becomes less and less of the original thought of, let's just get some light padding on and let's just beat the snot out of each other. And the machismo that comes with the new mindset. And unfortunately, that's made its way into Kempo and other martial arts. Unfortunately, there's a lot of guys, and I know some, that train MMA or BJ on the outside and train Kempo, and that the machismo mindset comes in. And the real question I want to ask some of these guys is, Do you honestly think that you can handle 3, 4, or 5 guys and that you're going to tap out every single one of them? Mm-hmm. Or is one of them going to go grab a baseball bat or go break a beer bottle, and all of a sudden you find yourself shanked while you're trying to tap this guy out? We often forget that Kenpo was originally designed and trained for multiple attackers, not a Brazilian jiu-jitsu mindset of it's mano a mano, one-on-one, I'm going to tap you out or I'm going to break your arm and not worry about anybody. This goes back to a side note. When I was younger, I was in police explorers and got to do a lot of ride-alongs with one of our local police officers. We were on a domestic disturbance call, one of the most dangerous things a police officer can do. And so we separated the husband and wife. It had been a known couple that has had issues. I was interviewing the wife. The other officer was interviewing the husband. The second that the officer started putting cuffs on the husband, the wife, in a flash of a second, grabbed a kitchen knife where I was doing the interview with and tried to charge the other officer. The officer was focused on the handcuffs and arresting of the husband and would not have known that the wife had a steak knife and was about to impale him. I think that same mindset then comes in the training with mano a mano arts of, I'm so hyper-focused on you, I don't know that the other person's got a baseball bat or a knife or a gun or any other type of weapon that levels the playing field. And just, I think, the training attitudes. Now, I know some Brazilian jiu-jitsu guys who have a great attitude, who don't bring that machismo into it. That Carlos de Valle, for instance, he's got a really great attitude, willing to learn from anybody, multiple different arts. But I really don't like the attitudes of some of the folks, and it's fostered within the studios. It kind of comes from the instructors now. Sure, you're fine one-on-one, but what if there's 10 guys? What's going to happen then? It's a legitimate question in my mind. So in many ways, I think it has made martial arts lose its original character and values. And for many people, put a bad taste in their mouth. And especially sometimes with the blends of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and Kenpo, that mindset comes in. Well, we're better than you because we also do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Let me go sit on top of this guy for 30 minutes and explain why Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Kenpo is better than American Kenpo. I've literally been in a seminar with a well-known Kenpo guy who says that his system's better, and he spent 30 minutes of an instructional session explaining why his version of Kenpo is better while laying on top of this one guy. Sorry, I'm not interested.
Yeah, no, there's always someone better, and there's no perfect, you know, perfect system. If there was, then everybody would just do that system. So yeah, there's always somebody better. There's always someone that has the better technique or better trained that technique or whatever. So yeah, that's unfortunate that there's still that kind of mindset out there. But, you know, we just have to take the good with the bad. So, work that out. And so go ahead.
Oh, sorry to interrupt.
Oh no, go ahead.
The main thing, the reason why my instructor and I put together Christian Kenpo was to put a buffer between some of these attitudes and our students, teaching them humility, realizing that you're not the sharpest tool in the shed, but what you have is a set of vocabulary, a set of skills to defend yourself and others when you have to do it. Never saying, oh, well, I know all the techniques in the world and I know all the defenses. We're the perfect art. No, instead is taking that horse pill called humility and going, I'm just here to train. I'm here to have fun. And heaven forbid I ever have to use this.
Exactly. All right. So I've got a few little kind of fun questions as we head towards the close of our time here. So first one being, do you have a favorite technique?
Oh, Wow, that's a tough one. Probably Dance of Darkness.
Good one.
I would say Dance of Darkness. It's a beautiful technique. When done in the air, it just looks like a dance. But on the body, when you see what the destruction, the kick punch combo, the popping of the arm, just the hidden pokes to the eyes, it is just a dismembering of a body in the air. And it's beautiful in both ways, just the fluidity of it and the destruction at the same time.
Very nice. Very nice. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
Yes. Yes, on both. So my favorite form to compete with is, obviously, you probably already know the answer, Form 4. Once again, it is very beautiful, very fluid, much like Form 6. That is another one of my favorites. But Form 4 is so iconic. It is the go-to, you know, competition form for most black belts. Form 6 is beautiful in if you know what you're looking at, if you're realizing that it's weapons, attacks, and defenses, realizing that it's not as flowery and outwardly beautiful like Form 4. As far as sets go, my favorite set would probably have to be Finger Set 2.
Okay. Very nice.
Movement with the finger set. Now, finger set one's lovely. Big thanks to Dr. Dave Crouch, who's trained in multiple different arts and looking at finger set from a ground perspective. Let's say you get taken to your back. You've got finger set. Finger set two introduces movement with it. So much like a coordination set where you're coordinating opposite hands and feet, finger set two is that movement and multiple attackers at the same time in different formations of the weapons in your hands. I think is a great demarcation between somebody who's a green belt and somebody who's a brown belt and how they're able to do finger set two.
Very nice. Very nice. Okay. If there is someone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, who would that be?
That would have to be Mr. Parker, hands down, without a doubt. I've had the great opportunity to talk with many and train with many who have been direct students of Mr. Parker and have known the family. Just hearing the stories and hearing conversations with Ed Parker Jr., I would really love to pick his brain. I remember hearing the story from Pat Salantri, who had taken lessons with Mr. Parker the last 4 or 5 years before Mr. Parker passed, and him telling the story of after Mr. Parker passed, the thing he missed the most was being able to just to pick up the phone and ask questions. I'd love to be able to have a lesson with Mr. Parker and ask him some of the same questions you asked me. What do you see? You know, what do you not like about where your art has gone or about the current state of martial arts? What do you think about just to pick his brain, not just about the art, American Kempo itself, but also the culture, the training methods, and to help, you know, steer the ship, so to speak. Yeah, I would have to say Mr. Parker.
Okay, fantastic. All right. And then the final question, since Ed Parker was a fan of jokes, I think it would be fun to have a joke there. So do you have a joke that you'd like to close us out with?
Oh, wow. joke. Well, my form of jokes are usually in the form of movie quotes.
Okay.
And particularly my favorite set of movie quotes is from Monty Python and the Search for the Holy Grail. So when you're never underestimate someone because they can be much like the rabbit in Monty Python and the Search for the Holy Grail. It's just a wee little bunny. Run away.
That's a great one. I like that. I like that. All right. Well, yes, I thank you so much for coming on and having a little chat with me today. I just love talking to people about Kempo and about the arts, and I'm just really, really thankful that that you were able to come on and share your story. Before we close out, is there anything else that that you have that maybe we didn't touch on and you'd like to mention, or shameless promotion, or whatever you want.
Shameless promotion and plug. Yeah, certainly. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. I don't consider myself to be much of anything in the martial arts community, so it's always interesting when somebody says, hey, want to interview you. Why?
Everybody's got a story. Everybody's important. Everybody has a story, and we need all of those, all of the perspectives and all of the stories. And, you know, of course I'm going to, I've reached out to the usual suspects and the OGs and everything, but they wouldn't be who they are without the rest of us. And, vice versa, they learn from our stories and from our experiences as well. So, everybody needs to be represented and have their story out there. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do this. So.
Yeah, I appreciate that purpose statement. Some shameless plugs, obviously, Karate for Christ International. If you're a Christian martial artist and you want a fellowship of like-minded believers from all different styles, Hapkido is highly represented, traditional styles of karate. Some Kempo practitioners, both Tracy's and Parker branded Kempo. Also, I have a YouTube channel. Just search my name and Kempo and it'll pop up. Pretty much, I think the entire 154 techniques are on there, and most of the extensions in our particular Pastelantri flavored Kempo, shall we say, is on there, as well as some of my training in other arts. And I put this out there to anyone. I feel much like a coach or an uncle. If anyone ever needs just another eyeball or another set of questions about, is this going right? Am I thinking about this right? I'm always free. Maybe it's my pastoral mindset. I do a lot of counseling during the week. Mm-hmm. As my main calling, I would call it. And so that, I think that filters into the martial arts as well. Just being there for people when they may not have somebody to talk to.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, thank you. Thank you again. I will be in touch when I get this ready to go out to the world. And thank you so much for your time. And we'll be in touch soon.
Thank you. Looking forward to seeing you wearing a brown belt.
Right on. Right on. Thank you.